This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 389 was produced on August 17th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Uranium Insider founder and publisher Justin Hune returns as this week's feature interview guest. Justin and I will begin with a review of the near to medium term bull case for uranium mining stocks before moving on to a longer term discussion about advanced nuclear technologies. And a quick housekeeping note, next week on August 24th, we'll be giving our production team their summer holiday, and that means we'll be airing a pre-recorded two-hour Macro Voices summer special episode, featuring an extra-long interview, but no market wrap or post-game segment. This year's topic will be the macro impacts and knock-on effects of artificial intelligence, featuring Freelancer.com CEO Matt Berry. We'll be back to our regular show format on August 31st.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, August 16th, 2023. The S&P 500 futures were down 145 basis points, closing at 4420. We'll take a closer look at that recent breakdown and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 95 basis points to 103.44. We completely now have retraced that July breakdown. The September WTI crude oil is down 595 basis points, closing at 79.38. Oil clearly started retracing after an impressive six-week $17 bull run. We'll take a look at the chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The December gold contract down 113 basis points, closing at 19.28. It has now broken those June lows and a next potential support now coming at the March lows near 1900. Copper down 317 basis points, closing at 366, trading back to May lows. Uranium up 133 basis points to 57.15, now just 50 cents away from trading back to year highs. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 24 basis points, closing at 4.25. Trading now directly at the 2022 highs. The key news to watch next week, we have the European and US PMIs and the University of Michigan consumer sentiment numbers. In addition, next week, we have the BRIC Summit and the Jackson Hole Symposium. This week's featured interview guest is Justin Hune. Eric, why did we invite Justin back as a guest this week?
Patrick, we had Justin on to do a uranium special at the end of last year, and quite frankly, that was really at the very beginning of my own journey of discovery of all things nuclear. I didn't know how to ask all the right questions. I think I do now, but we'll see what happens. So I'm really excited to get Justin back. Meanwhile, since we talked to him last, there's been a pretty significant rally. Looks like it may have legs and continue. I definitely want to ask Justin whether or not that's the case. And it's been more than 6 months since we did an update on uranium, so we're definitely going to start making that a regular event here on Macro Voices.
Eric's interview with Uranium Insider founder and publisher Justin Hune is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Uranium Insider Newsletter founder and publisher Justin Hune. Justin prepared a slide deck for this week's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button above Justin's picture that says, looking for the downloads. Justin, it's so exciting for me to get you back on the show. The last time I interviewed you, I was just beginning my own journey of education around all things nuclear. Didn't frankly know what the hell I was talking about, as some of our listeners politely and others not so politely let me know. Now I think I know enough to be dangerous, so hopefully I won't embarrass myself too much in this interview. But I'm super excited. I've been following your newsletter quite closely for many months now. starting to build my positions in uranium and in other nuclear technologies, and very excited about this future. So I want to get an update. Last time I talked to you, I was kind of talking long-term nuclear renaissance stuff, what I see on the horizon long-term, and you were saying, look, it doesn't even matter whether that comes true or not. There's this specific setup that was bullish in the uranium market, regardless of whether there's a policy change or a nuclear renaissance or any of that. It just has to do with fuel cycles and so forth. So as I see on your first slide here on page one of your deck, you're talking about the renaissance. Has anything changed in terms of there being a setup that is independent of that? And if so, or if not, how does the renaissance angle come into it? And when are we going to start to see the market discount that? Because, boy, I don't think we've really realized what's coming yet.
Sure. Yeah. Good points, Eric. And thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to talking with you again. And you're right. Our last chat, we kind of did a 30,000 foot view of the broader picture, the broader thesis, longer term vision, et cetera. And you're absolutely right. Some of the exciting developments for nuclear and the future of nuclear in terms of new countries pledging to build new nuclear, countries expanding on nuclear, carbon neutrality goals, net zero goals, et cetera, et cetera. The advancement of SMR, small modular reactors, advanced nuclear reactors. These are all very exciting. For me, they're most exciting for just the abundance for humanity in the future kind of level, not necessarily from an investing standpoint, because none of these new major build-out plans going out into the 2030s, nor the potential snowballing adoption of small modular reactors have any effect whatsoever on the short to near kind of midterm investing thesis. And so, Eric, if you actually just model out existing nuclear reactors under construction that will be grid connected in the next 5 years or so, and you look at demand based on that alone with no other demand from future builds, we're going to see a significant supply shortfall and therefore pressure on rising prices. And that's really kind of the fundamental basis for this is as a commodity investment is looking at the supply and demand picture. What does that look like for the next 5, 6, 7 years? And I can tell you it looks extremely bullish for the commodity.
Justin, tell me more about the two green charts that I see on page one. What are these indicating and what do they tell me?
So these two charts are actually from something called the Liftoff Report that was put out by the United States Department of Energy. I believe it was back in March, a couple months after we spoke originally. And this is a report that the DOE put out three different reports, one based on the hydrogen economy, one based on renewable energy, and one based on the expansion of nuclear. And it's essentially an acknowledging of the pretty significant expansion of nuclear in the United States that will be necessary to reach these, you know, 2050 carbon neutrality goals for the country. And these two charts essentially are representing the two options of deployment, whether or not we get this started now and actually have new nuclear builds, construction starts before 2030, and if it waits until 2035, and how much more difficult, how much faster we will have to get things done if we wait another 10 years to get this going. The important point of this slide really is to recognize that the United States Department of Energy under a Democratic presidential leadership is actually promoting the doubling and possibly even tripling eventually of nuclear power. So this is showing a 200 gigawatts of nuclear, and these are new builds nuclear, not total capacity. We currently have something like 93, 94 gigawatts in the United States. So this is literally a tripling of nuclear that is being suggested by the Department of Energy. So this is very, very new sentiment around this technology, where we've been in multiple decades of negative sentiment around nuclear. Now this is actually a bipartisan supportive sector for the United States governmental leadership. And this is very new. It's very exciting. You know, new nuclear in the United States is not on anybody's bingo card and definitely not in anybody's supply and demand modeling. And I'm not holding my breath for this to happen, but this is just a shining example of how significantly the sentiment for the sector has shifted in the last couple of years.
I really want to drill down on this point and understand it a little better because I am at a handicap here. What I'm experiencing, Justin, is every time I turn around, I see signs of the world finally waking up and getting the nuclear message, literally down to the level of Miss America using her title to essentially become a pro-nuclear activist and use the attention that she gets from being Miss America to help promote awareness of the merits of nuclear energy. okay, that was not happening. You know, I never noticed anything like that. I'm feeling like all of a sudden there's a tide shift here and it's big. But then I stop and I say, wait a minute. I just got interested in this like less than a year ago. And I started following Twitter accounts that promote information like yours about all things nuclear. You've been in this for several years. Are you seeing something that's not, oh, it's interesting signs of progress, but rather interesting signs of progress that are suddenly really seeming to accelerate in the last 6 months? Or am I just perceiving that because I started paying attention to a new subject that I wasn't paying attention to?
I would say that it started to shift a little bit earlier than just a 6 month time frame, but it's really accelerated. And part of that acceleration has to do with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That really put a highlight on nations' energy security. So, for example, Europe is highly dependent on Russian natural gas, coal, and oil. And when those supplies were interrupted because of this conflict, you actually had a very fine point put on national energy security. And nuclear just achieves that pretty much better than anything. If you have a nuclear reactor constructed and up and operating in your country, you can store decades worth of nuclear fuel in a small warehouse. And that's huge for energy security, but also national security. But that, of course, is just kind of on the heels of a very strong movement towards lower carbon emissions, net neutrality, net zero carbon goals for most countries on the planet. And whether or not, you know, you're on board for that type of narrative, that is what is happening. And finally, nuclear is getting some recognition for being a clear and obvious answer for, you know, consistent baseload clean power. So the narrative has been shifting for a few years, but it just continues to accelerate. I'll give you a couple of examples. On slide number 4, I list a number of countries that have recently announced reactor life extensions. What I didn't include on this slide was new reactor builds, countries that are building new nuclear. There's dozens of countries building new nuclear. In fact, just in the last week, Uganda, that only has 1.3 gigawatts of currently installed electricity capacity, is looking at making a deal with the South Koreans and with the Russians to build out over 15 gigawatts of new nuclear. I mean, this just is coming out of left field. But all of these countries here are announcing life extensions on this slide, on slide number 4. And life extensions, very differently from new builds in nuclear, have immediate effects on uranium demand. So that's, I'm definitely more bulled up about life extensions and reactor restarts than new nuclear. But yes, I mean, long answer short, Eric, the narrative has been shifting for, you know, probably about 2 to 3 years, and it's been slow moving, and it just seems to be kind of going on this hockey stick type move in terms of nuclear adoption and support of nuclear. When I first was familiar with this investing thesis back in 2016, you know, the original bet was this is a sector that everybody is ignoring. Most people hate it. The commodity is completely bombed out and is trading at, you know, a third of the price it needs to be in order to incentivize new projects. Supply and demand is all skewed, but there was a lot of abundant supply in the market, so it took some time to work through that. But, you know, really the point was that was a bet on the sector going from absolutely terrible to just bad. We're looking at 1% growth for the sector, maybe. Now we're looking at a 4%, 5%, 6% annual growth rate for nuclear going out as far as we can look in the future.
Wow, lots of really good stuff to unpack. I want to go back to the beginning of your answer first, and then I'll come back to some of your last points. Talking about the geopolitical stuff on page 2, tell me a little bit more about that, because it seems to me like there's been an ecosystem of uranium that's been actually, I would say, surprisingly open on a global basis for the last couple of decades, where you had, for example, the megatons to megawatts program, where there was actually a partnership between the United States and Russia to take Russian nuclear warheads, downblend the plutonium in them in order to make, non-weapons grade fissile material that could then be used in American reactors. We had this partnership. Well, obviously, geopolitics have changed. Okay, what exactly is that going to mean? I could imagine that that means there's a whole bunch of supply coming from a part of the world that we might lose access to that's going to completely change things. But I got to believe there's also some curveballs where this could work the other way. So what things do people need to think about in terms of what could happen in the world and what that's going to do to your investment thesis around uranium?
The really short answer to that, Eric, would be that supply is fragile currently. So, and the biggest driver of that statement has to do with almost half of the annual supply of uranium coming from a single country, and that's Kazakhstan. So really what your listeners should understand is that the uranium market is and has been a global market. To your point, the Megatons to Megawatts program, which ran from 1993 to 2013, was somewhat of an off-balance sheet asset for nuclear utilities. It was 20 million pounds per year of secondary supply that didn't come out of the ground from a mine that definitely aided in the suppressing of the price of uranium for a very long period of time. And that's not there any longer. But coming back to kind of geopolitics, Kazakhstan is in a very, very interesting and precarious geopolitical position. So they have been a reliable supplier of uranium to the West and to the East for a very long time. In fact, they were ramping supply, ramping production so significantly from the mid-2000s into about the mid-2010s, they went from just producing a few million pounds a year to being the largest supplier of uranium in the world at roughly around 60 million pounds of uranium produced on an annual basis, which is absolutely insane. And if you look at this slide number two here, this is actually coming from their fiscal year 2022 investor handout, Kazatomprom, which is the uranium producer in Kazakhstan. They're majority owned by the state of Kazakhstan, but they are 25% public, listed on the LSE. But you can see that even for 2022, their Asian market is almost half of their sales. And in 2022, for example, the United States bought a lot of uranium from Kazakhstan, and that is going to change. And the reason that is going to change is there's multiple reasons. So one is that transportation has become a problem during this particular conflict in the Ukraine. So instead of shipping material to the West, starting by heading north via rail to the port of St. Petersburg and then out to sea, they're shipping the material straight west through the Caspian Sea, through the Black Sea, through a number of countries with their own geopolitical conflicts happening currently. And the cost of transportation heading west rather than going through that port is something to the tune of 20x the price. This has caused a lot of problems in deliveries over the past 18 months for Western customers of Kazatomprom. The other point I want to make is that ties between this country and both Russia and China continue to deepen. A couple of big examples of that have happened since our last conversation, Eric. One is that the company confirmed that back in December, this large new mine in Kazakhstan called the Budenovskoy, the 6 and 7 blocks of the Budenovskoy deposit, a lot of uranium held in this deposit. That mine, 49% ownership of that mine was pushed through to Rosatom. So the Russians now have engaged in a new joint venture with Kazakhstan since the invasion of Ukraine. And this, of course, has terrible optics to the West, but it also means this big new supply of uranium, half of that's going to end up in Russia. And a chunk of the other half that's owned by Kazatomprom is going to end up in the East. One more example would be that CNNC, China National Nuclear Corporation, they signed a very large contract with Kazatomprom. Now, we don't yet know the actual numbers on this contract, but we do know that it's chunky. We know that because Kazatomprom had to have a special shareholder vote to approve a contract that would push the total size of contracts from this one entity beyond 50% of the book value of the company. So this is a very large contract. This is yet another sign that China's massive nuclear build-out is going to lead towards China securing more pounds of uranium on a global basis. But where is it easiest found for China? It's right there in Kazakhstan. They're building a gigantic warehouse right on the border of the two countries. More pounds from Kazakhstan are going to end up in Russia and China, and that's a problem for the West.
Justin, let's move on to slide 3, where you're showing renewable energy or its frailties. And this is something I've been thinking about for a long time, which is there a moment where maybe people wake up and they say, wait a minute, we've been doing all this wind and solar stuff because it really does feel like the best, cleanest, greenest way to do, you know, clean energy. Maybe it's time to look a little bit more carefully at the engineering data and realize that wind and solar is not completely without fault. And maybe some of that nuclear stuff really is more appealing, even though it doesn't sound like it would be.
Sure. Yeah. There's plenty of evidence that's starting to come out after now that we have years and years and years of pushing extremely hard on expanding both wind and solar in multiple places around the world. I think in our last conversation, we talked pretty substantially about Germany and the failure of their Energy Vendi program, and where they've put, you know, more than $500 billion into the expansion of solar and wind in the country while simultaneously shutting down all of their nuclear reactors. And they're actually producing more carbon emissions in the country than they did before the Energy Vendi program even started. And they have extremely high energy costs. Look, the cheapness of solar, for example, has a lot to do with not only subsidies in the areas where it's being built. You know, I'm here in the United States, and there's plenty of subsidies for the expansion of solar electricity, both on the on multiple state levels. I'm in California, and on the federal level. And it, you're also exporting the cost. So most of the solar panels come from China. In China, there are very little environmental regulations. They produce solar panels with coal energy. You know, you need extremely high temperatures to create polysilicon, and that is done primarily with coal, whether in China or elsewhere. And you also have, you know, oftentimes, if not extremely cheap labor, slave labor, to put it mildly. And so what you have is sort of a false sense of affordability of these technologies. And that starts to couple with what we're seeing as being frailty with these technologies. So solar panels, for example, in the first photo in this slide is showing a solar field in Texas that recently got hit with a hailstorm. This is a field that had a 30 to 35 year expected lifespan, and it lasted 4 years. So when you see these levelized cost of energy, these LCOE comparisons of renewables to nuclear and fossil fuels, et cetera, they're baking in a whole bunch of assumptions. They're baking in the cost of implementation, which, like I mentioned, is subsidized by various factors. And they're basing it on an expected lifespan. So, you know, the levelized cost of energy, essentially, that sort of metric is a lie, to put it lightly. You have to...
Justin, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to go a little deeper on LCOE, levelized cost of energy, because that's a really important topic that we haven't discussed in much detail. I don't think we've ever brought it up on Macro Voices before. Some of our listeners may not be familiar. The idea here is that the whole world has kind of organized a lot of energy measurements around things like barrels of oil. Well, if we're going to consider other forms of energy, we need to start thinking about energy in terms of the energy we produce, not the amount of fossil fuels we consume. So levelized cost of energy is meant to be a way to be able to look at a whole bunch of different clean energy sources, whether it's wind, solar, so forth, and essentially have them all competing on a level playing field where we can see through one number which one is truly superior to the other. And it's completely fair, and it doesn't give any unfair bias to one energy source over the other. Is that a true statement, or is it actually not so clean?
So part of the problem with LCOE is it's making an attempt at measuring the lifetime costs of implementing any particular source of electricity divided by the expected energy production of that particular source of electricity. And one of the problems is that it has to bake into certain assumptions, right? So for example, the LCOE of this particular solar field that I mentioned in Texas that got destroyed by hail was probably very, very low on its initial calculations. However, because it lasted 4 years and not 35, the numbers that were cited in order to promote the implementation of this particular solar field were completely ridiculously low and not even remotely close to being accurate. So you also have to bake into assumptions when you look at LCOE of nuclear, which is also extremely problematic because you have nuclear in China or in the UAE built by the South Koreans versus, you know, the Vogtle plant that was recently built in Georgia. Vastly, vastly different cost structures for these plants based on where they are built, how much it cost for those to be built. You also have LCOE influenced by the expectation of the lifespan of nuclear reactors. So you might actually have, you know, the initial license will be what provides that LCOE number, which in most cases is a 40-year operating lifespan. In the United States right now, we're looking at giving life extensions to reactors that fit the safety protocols, 80-year and potentially up to 100-year lifespans. So these numbers really they're just thrown out there, and they're very difficult to hang your hat on. And you have to also look at the value for society that cannot be measured in having stable electricity. Just to go back to Europe again, they've had periods of basically negative electricity prices because it was an extremely, extremely windy day. And the Germans and the Danes had negative prices of electricity, in some cases the UK as well. Well, that happens on a single day when you don't necessarily even need that electricity, or at least that level of electricity. But when you need the electricity, you cannot rely on it being there. You know, and of course, there's some cases for where offshore wind might make a lot of sense, or where solar might make a lot of sense. But even in those places like Southern California, for example, which is where I live, California has drastically expanded solar in the last decade or so. We have the highest electricity prices we've ever paid in the state. So the let's implement renewables because it's so cheap, it's going to lower your bills. There's yet to be any evidence of that, other than maybe rooftop solar where the electricity provider is actually paying you for the energy you're generating. But guess what? They're phasing that out in California as well. And you actually are going to have to start to pay Southern California Edison and PG&E if you have solar on your roof. Now, if you have a legacy solar grid on your rooftop, that's fine. But any new solar in the state, it's going to be working in the opposite direction. Why? Because finally, it's become obvious, which should have been obvious all along, this intermittency is very challenging for the grid. And it requires either battery backups or another baseload energy source that can cycle up and down easily to match the intermittency. That's gas, that's coal.
Something that really concerns me, Justin, is so many people are being told the answer, and it's a beautiful one, is all you need to do is just add batteries to that wind that you're talking about, and it solves the whole thing. And you know what, Justin? If we were not competing with electric vehicles, or if electric vehicles were not competing with the need to use batteries, that might make sense. But we've only got, it's basically going to be impossible to mine all of the battery metals needed to make all the electric vehicles that people think are going to be made. We don't have enough battery metals to make batteries for windmills, when windmills were never really the smartest way to make clean energy to start with.
Correct. Yep, that's absolutely correct. I think an important point too is to just kind of, and we covered this a little bit in our first chat as well, Eric, is the energy return on invested, you know, the actual energy you get back from what you invested in establishing that source of energy, that has increased over time since the inception of electricity throughout history. This is the first time in history where we're actually attempting to go in reverse. So you have an EROI with, you know, natural gas currently, let's say it's somewhere around a 20 or 25 to 1 return on investment. Solar PV with battery backup, you have basically zero energy return on invested because it's so energy intensive to mine the battery metals and establish these grids. And then you look at the frailty of those grids, the fact that batteries don't last forever, you have to toss them, rebuild them, recycle them, whatever it might be. I mean, it's just an extremely, extremely inefficient way to try to keep society operating as it is now. Now, I'm not trying to just completely, you know, poo-poo the idea of renewables across the board. I think there's a time and a place for them. But saying that we need to go 100% renewables, we can establish a firm, reliable, clean grid that's 100% run on renewables with battery backup is basically an unarithmetic pipe dream. It's not going to happen. It cannot happen. Physics will not allow it to happen. And the reason you see a lot of, historically speaking, a lot of the sort of the quote unquote green NGOs be anti-nuclear is because when you have nuclear, you don't need renewables. It's just baseload and it's clean and it threatens these industries. And that's one reason, in my personal opinion, why we've seen an anti-nuclear movement over the past decades. Finally, physics is starting to win out.
Justin, let's move on to slide 5, where we're talking about the future of nuclear, where it's headed, nuclear renaissance and so forth. I really want to get your perspective on this because, frankly, you know, first of all, I absolutely love your newsletter. I've been following a lot of your trade recommendations. I'm enjoying building a position in uranium mining stocks. But you know what? If I think about what I see on the horizon in terms of a nuclear renaissance that I'm convinced will happen, not because people are smart enough to think it needs to happen, it's because I think we're at the point where we're only a few years from being forced to recognize it's the only sane solution that there is and that there are no other options. And I think that's where the really, really big nuclear renaissance is going to come from. I feel like I am in 1998 and I know exactly what's going to happen with Google and I want to invest in it. So what we're doing is I've got Justin's newsletter, and with Justin's advice, I'm buying stock in the catering company that serves lunch to Google, because, you know, that's going to grow with Google. And I'm going to buy some stock in, I don't know, the people that make stationery or whatever. The actual industry, there's no good way to invest in it because we don't know who the real players are going to be. And a lot of the people, or a lot of the companies that will benefit the most from, you know, if there's going to be a whole bunch more nuclear plants, then there's going to be a whole bunch more demand for turbines, you know, steam turbines. And so Siemens is going to do well, but that's not a pure play. There's no good way to invest in what's coming that I can see. And I feel like we're investing in uranium, not because it's the smart thing to do, but because it's the only thing we can figure out to do in order to bet on what we see coming. Do you see it that way?
Not necessarily, but I do see your point. By the way, I personally think we're going to see one or two IPOs, maybe even more on an annual basis, of new companies that are building, designing and potentially building small modular reactors and advanced nuclear reactor design. So I think this space is going to grow. I think in the coming years, there'll be far more investable vehicles to expose yourself, you know, directly to the nuclear reactor builders. But yes, you definitely have a point. It's difficult to invest in the space aside from the actual fuel. Now, the good news on that front is all of these new reactor designs, I suppose with the exception of thorium-fueled molten salt reactors, are fueled by uranium. And uranium, you know, there's just no other option. You have to fuel these with uranium, enriched uranium fabricated fuel. So,
well, hang on a second, because I want to test that. First of all, I do agree with you, and I do agree in the end that there's a very strong uranium bullish case here. But let's just talk this through for the sake of completeness. Imagine, and this is pure fantasy now, that governments around the world got their shit together and did the right thing to serve the people who elected them. What they would do very quickly is they would round up all 250,000 tons of nuclear waste, spent nuclear fuel waste, which is in storage around the world. They would tell Orano and France and other companies around the world to gear up to reprocess, recycle. Yes, it is possible to recycle nuclear waste. France has been doing it for years. Other countries don't follow suit because their governments are not paying attention. If we were to simply recycle all 250,000 tons of spent fuel waste that's already in storage, that would produce 237,000 tons of perfectly good U-308 uranium that could be used to make more fuel rods with, or could be used to fuel more reactors. And furthermore, if we really got our shit together, we'd start using breeder reactors that are 20 times more fuel efficient than once through pressurized water reactors. And we wouldn't need so much uranium. So you could see the market get flooded with recycled uranium because governments around the world finally started being responsible and doing the right thing. And, you know, you wouldn't need uranium miners for a little while. Now, I don't have any fantasies about governments doing the right thing, so I'm still buying uranium stocks. But in theory, if we really got our shit together, we wouldn't need so much uranium, would we?
I suppose in theory, you have a decent point there, but I'm going to push back a little bit and say that despite the fact that there's abundant potential uranium held in nuclear waste, we have yet to see any evidence of that utilization of that expanding. So for example, the Russians do a bit of reprocessing, the French do a bit of reprocessing, the Japanese are looking at doing a bit of reprocessing, but it's still a very, very small amount relative to their needs. And so the French, for example, and the Russians continue to expand in mining uranium. The French are setting up a joint venture in Mongolia to mine uranium with ISR. They're expanding in Uzbekistan, they're expanding in Kazakhstan. They're expanding in Africa. The Russians are doing largely the same in Africa and Kazakhstan. And so reprocessing is very expensive. It's known as MOX fuel, mixed oxide fuel. And basically, you have to have an extremely complex chemical separation where you're actually pulling the plutonium out of the nuclear waste and mixing that with a bit of recycled uranium and a bit of fresh uranium as well. And it's very expensive to do. And the cost really is probably the primary reason why this hasn't been more widely adopted. So this is, in theory, could this expand? And will we see more reprocessing fuel if we see a continuation of expansion of nuclear demand on a global basis? Probably. Will this happen in the next 3 to 5 years? No. So it has absolutely no threat whatsoever to this particular investing thesis. But you also have to look at general sentiment around fuel amongst folks who are not necessarily all that familiar with nuclear versus the industry's reality. And the sentiment around fuel is like, oh, what about the waste? What about the waste? That's a big problem. And the industry's reality is nuclear produces such a tiny amount of waste relative to the amount of electricity it produces. It has a perfect safety track record. It's easy to store. It really isn't a problem. So despite the fact that, you know, every single nuclear utility has some waste sitting at their facility, the motivation, especially with price, to reprocess that material is just not there. Now, if we see sustained prices north of, you know, $150 a pound for a long period of time, will we see an expansion of reprocessing? Possibly. But there's just no evidence of that yet. And as far as different type of reactors, I completely agree with you. I think all of these various advanced reactor types that are far more efficient, in some cases might run on thorium with the molten salt reactors. We're still seeing a vast expansion of large light water and boiling water reactors. That's primarily what all of these countries are building. So while there is great hope for these advanced designs, and I cross my fingers that these will be built and we will move in that direction, there isn't any evidence yet that that's happening. So what is happening now? There's 55, 56 large light water reactors, boiling water reactors, pressurized water reactors under construction globally right now. And the Chinese are building, you know, 10 more a year. So that's what's happening. That's what's going to be happening in the next, you know, few years as far as this investment is concerned. When we're talking about the mid-2030s and beyond, are we going to see new designs that don't require as much or any uranium at all? It's entirely possible, but that's yet to be seen.
Let's talk about China's role in the future of uranium and energy, and frankly, the role of uranium and energy in defining China's role in the world in coming years. Because it seems to me like if I look at what's going on, you know, I saw Kirk Sorensen's thorium videos back in 2011 when he first put them out. I thought it was really cool. All of my advisors told me, don't even think about it, you know, investing in it, because the U.S. government's, you know, got its head up its ass. It doesn't know how to regulate those things. There's no potential whatsoever because the government's in the way. And meanwhile, people in China saw those same videos. China built, it's actually constructed and it's been approved to go into operation. China built a full-scale thorium-fueled molten salt reactor, as far as I can tell, in reaction to Kirk Sorensen's videos where he was trying to wake up the U.S. government. China got the memo, and China has made an announcement that they're going to make a huge commitment to nuclear. I think you and I, Justin, both see something that I think you see, that I can see, which is this SMR industry, the industry that builds hundreds of thousands over the long run of small modular reactors that completely replace fossil fuels over the next 50 years. That industry is not the kind of industry that's just something interesting to make money in. That's the kind of industry that changes the balance of power in the world. Whichever country controls that industry has a huge economic advantage because they have an energy advantage. If you're making all the SMRs and you're the United States, or if you're China, well, then having that control means you've got a huge economic advantage over the rest of the world because you've got a lower cost of energy for your manufacturing. It's a really, really big deal in the course of the world. That's how big SMRs are going to be. And as far as I can tell, China is a country with a massive, massive manufacturing infrastructure, and they've already got the lead on thorium-fueled molten salt. Are we screwed? I mean, is it just a matter of time until China wins the control of this market?
I wouldn't say we're necessarily screwed, but they certainly are way, way ahead of us. When I say us, I'm talking about the United States and I suppose the West generally, although, you know, the French are doing.
And I don't know of any advantage that China has that was not delivered to them on a silver platter by, you know, essentially let's spend a whole bunch of American tax dollars figuring out how to get nuclear right will write it all up in research papers at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, then fire Alvin Weinberg, the guy who was responsible for all of it, because it competes with something in the president's home state of California, and we'll throw it all away and forget about it, and let China, our competitor, pick up that research and use it to create an advantage and allow them to use it in a way that allows China to literally replace the United States as the global economic and military hegemonic power over the world. That's a really big deal, and it's very concerning to me that I think China is very, very much in the lead on advanced nuclear. Please tell me why I have it wrong. I mean, I really, really want to have this wrong.
Well, there's a lot I could say about that, but I'm probably not going to go down that road too far. I mean, there's no shortage of evidence of political missteps and squandering of opportunities on behalf of the United States political leadership over the last couple of decades. But to put it simply, China thinks in decades, and they play the patient long game. And when they see an area where they can take an advantage, they go for it. And this is one of those areas. You know, interestingly enough, with nuclear, because there's only so many countries that have the historical precedence of building nuclear, the know-how, the skilled labor, the engineering know-how to actually build nuclear, making a deal to build a nuclear power plant in your country typically happens with an export country. So for example, like I mentioned, the United Arab Emirates just built four reactors, the four units at the Baraka power station in the UAE. And the South Koreans built those reactors, and they did an absolutely phenomenal job on time, on budget, just brilliant, brilliant pieces of engineering. And it's going to set up this oil-rich country very, very, very well for the future. Now, they're building two more, and they're looking at potentially building a total of eight reactors, which would be 25% of their electricity needs coming from nuclear. But, you know, oftentimes what happens is these nuclear contracts are actually kind of geopolitical alignments as much as they are seeking energy security for your country. For example, Poland has recently announced they are going kind of all in on nuclear with large reactors and small modular reactors. And they had bids from the South Koreans, from Westinghouse, and from the French, and they chose to go with Westinghouse, not because it was the cheapest, not because they have a better track record of building than the South Koreans do, but because they wanted to plant a flag with geopolitical alignment with the United States. I mean, that's just kind of the reality of it. So to the extent that China is eating everybody's lunch in, as far as nuclear builds go, with domestic builds, they are. But there are other significant established players in the export business. And this is primarily the Russians. The Russians have the largest export book, even now after this invasion. And some of those contracts have reneged, like with the Finnish. But they still have the largest export book. But the South Koreans are deeply established. The United States, with Westinghouse, continues to be a major player on the global stage. So it's kind of like an all-out sort of quote-unquote arms race in terms of who can build nuclear plants the best and the fastest, and how can we get it done? And the geopolitical alignments along those lines are significant. China, of course, is looking at drastically expanding their electricity infrastructure. Like I mentioned, they're aiming to build 10 reactors per year for the next decade or so. To put that into perspective, they currently have 53 gigawatts of nuclear in China right now. They're trying to hit 150 gigawatts by 2030. So that's another 90-something reactors in the next 6.5 years. Will they hit that? I don't know. They just announced approved 6 construction starts for new nuclear 2 weeks ago. In a single week, 6 new construction starts for new nuclear. So China is moving that direction very, very quickly, and they're going to need a hell of a lot of uranium for this build out.
Justin, I want to go back to something very important that you just said, which is China really is kind of in the lead at the moment in the race to build the most nuclear plants. I agree with you that that's what almost everybody is focused on, is how many new nuclear plants, like the old kind, are going to get built. I'm going to make the argument that that is very, very important to the history of the world, but not nearly as important as the next really big thing to come next, which is SMRs. Because I think that once you achieve assembly line efficiencies of scale, that you completely change the game, and that the way we're going to solve this energy transition is with mass producing small modular reactors on assembly lines. So unfortunately, I think that's an even stronger case in China's favor. But you also said Russia really is who's got the export book. Do you see China setting up to get into the business, competing with Russia for exporting reactors? Or do you think they're not going to pursue that for some reason?
Well, they're definitely already in that business when it comes to large reactors. When it comes to
I mean, for SMRs.
Yes. Well, for SMRs, I think that they're going to be one of the many players, but they're not necessarily, quote unquote, in the lead of this particular race with SMRs. The South Koreans are definitely up there. GE Hitachi is, in my opinion, what seems to be gaining the most market share in these very, very early days of this next big wave that's coming, which I completely agree with you. I think this is the future. You know, if you look at slide number five, Eric, this is, comes from the Breakthrough Institute. This is a chart basically showing how the expected, and again, here using levelized cost of electricity, but that's, you know, just we're just looking at initial capital to establish this these technologies. You know, the first of a kind is always more expensive. Once you get to nth of a kind and you're building multiple reactors with that supply chain efficiency, we should see the cost dramatically fall for small modular reactors once we start to get these going. Right now, what's happening is there's a race to see which designs can garner the most market attention. So right now, we've got NuScale's Voyager, which is a light water small modular reactor, X Energy's XE100, TerraPower's Natrium, GE Hitachi's BWRX300. These are really the big names. There's a handful of others, and there's more than 80 different SMR designs currently being developed right now. So China is not necessarily in the lead when it comes to a global market share for initial orders of small modular reactors. So far, that seemed to be GE Hitachi with the BWRX300, but you know, who knows? I don't think it's going to be one design that's going to be the clear winner. There's probably going to be multiples because there's multiple different use cases. The advantage of the small modular light water reactors is the design is very familiar for any countries that already have nuclear established. So it's a familiar thing as far as regulations go. Some of these reactors like X Energy's XE100, which is a gas-cooled high-temperature reactor, that produces very, very high temperatures, and you can actually utilize it not just for electricity, but for industrial steam and industrial heat. And in fact, they have a number of letters of intent with Dow Chemical operating in Texas to build a number of these small XE100 reactors. So it's a very exciting period of time for this space because it's yet to really hit, but the orders are coming in by the hundreds, and it looks like it's moving in that direction. And there's multiple use cases for small modular reactors. It's not just industrial heat. It's not just the fact that they're small, which will allow them to be implemented into smaller electricity grids, but also, in theory, if they can be built faster, that has a major advantage, especially in Western countries that have to deal with a lot of red tape and bureaucracies that can slow down projects with expensive capital currently with interest rates. The faster you can build something, the more attractive that project is going to be. So amongst, let's say, the nuclear utilities in the United States that are looking at new nuclear, most of them are looking at small modular reactors rather than building new large reactors.
I should correct my statement about China earlier, because you're exactly right, Justin. China is not even in the SMR business at all right now. So to say that they're a leader or that they're in the lead doesn't seem to make sense. What I meant is, in my opinion, China is very much in the lead with respect to advanced nuclear. And by that, I mean molten salt and thorium fuel. I allow myself to kind of get ahead of myself. I ought to remind myself that the first many years of the SMR industry are going to be entirely about pressurized water reactors that burn uranium and nothing else. I can't help the fact, as a futurist, I just think about the thorium-fueled molten salt future that I envision for the world. And boy, I think China has got the lead with the work that SINAP is doing, the Shanghai Institute of Applied Physics, and their thorium-fueled reactor that they've already built. I think they've got the lead in terms of being able to step up and say, oh, if what is going to change the course of the world is whichever nation is in charge of the SMR industry that fully embraces all of the advanced nuclear technology, when China figures out that that's going to be the important thing, they're in the position to do it. And I don't think anybody else is. Am I missing anything?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't say that there isn't anybody else in that position, but I think that they're clearly...
They're ahead, and they've got money, and they figured it out, and their government is behind them. And if I look at all of the molten salt companies whose governments are not behind them, there's a big difference there.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, they're ahead. And and part of the reason they're ahead is because, again, they're not dealing with as significant red tape and bureaucracy challenges that you would face, in, for example, in the United States. But yeah, they're certainly ahead in terms of actually letting the rubber meet the road and building some of these different technologies. You know, in your point with thorium, I think is really interesting. So about 10% of the world's reactors are what are known as heavy water reactors or CANDU reactors, Canadian deuterium reactors. And all of Canada's fleet are CANDU reactors. And I don't know why there's not more attention or more CANDU reactors being built, because these things are pretty fantastic. They run on natural uranium. It doesn't have to be enriched, but they theoretically can run on thorium with a little bit of plutonium. That has yet to actually happen. Why? Reactor operators are hesitant to utilize different fuels in their reactors, because what is working, and why fix it if it isn't broken? But theoretically speaking, heavy water reactors can run on thorium with a little bit of plutonium, which I find fascinating. But still, again, you know, a lot of these advanced reactor designs are very exciting and have huge future potential. But as far as the investing case is concerned, you can really keep it pretty simple and looking at what's the existing fleet, what reactors are going to hit the grid in the next 5 to 7 years, how much demand is that going to create, and what's the supply side look like? And then again, just looking at the evidence of what is actually being built. You know, we see large gigawatt scale pressurized water reactors being announced almost on a weekly basis now in various countries. So despite the fact that we have exciting advanced technologies at the forefront that look like they're coming, we still see countries choosing to build more of what is already familiar. And there's really nothing wrong with the existing nuclear designs, but these advanced designs, I agree with you. I'm very excited about them for the future.
Well, and I should apologize for getting ahead of myself, because I can't stop talking about them and I could spend hours on it. Let's follow your lead and come back to what more of our listeners are probably interested in, which is making money on this stuff right now. The strategy is basically invest in uranium mining companies, because that's the closest thing we can get to a pure play. You've got companies like NuScale going public, which are finally starting to provide a pure play SMR investment, but that's the first one. You know, it's brand new. The trade is either uranium itself, which you hold through the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, or it's uranium mining shares. My strategy for that is to follow your newsletter to get the advice on which uranium mining shares to invest in. In terms of market timing and so forth, is this a good time? Is it a bad time? We went through a route that you guys didn't really see coming, but it seems like we've really rallied nicely out of that. Has this rally got legs? Are we going to go back down and retest that? What do you think?
Well, I think it has legs, but I think that we potentially have some broad market headwinds. I mean, the day that we're recording this, we're dealing with a kind of a gap down in the broad indices, and the uranium stocks are selling off a bit. But I think the timing right now currently is pretty exciting for a number of reasons. And one is, you know, we're kind of in the first sort of recovery phase of a very long term, a year and a half long consolidation following the previous peak of kind of the first leg up for this market. So we've had a big reset in terms of valuations for the uranium miners, which gets me excited, because my conviction for being long here is extremely high for obvious reasons. We're also coming into what is typically a stronger season for the commodity. Usually Q4, Q1 is when we see moves up in the price of uranium. The reason is we have utilities coming back from the slow summer season, from summer vacations. We have the big WNA, World Nuclear Association conference in London in the first week of September. Then there's a number of nuclear fuel conferences in the fall, and that's typically when utilities come back to the table and to secure more pounds in the long-term market, and in some cases in the spot market. So I don't really like to bet on the short term. But all things considered, considering the fact that we've seen a big correction, considering the fact that the technical charts of most of the stocks in the space and the commodity itself look absolutely gorgeous here, we're finally seeing some long-term moving averages tick up and the short-term moving averages above those long-term moving averages, with the stocks trading above all of that. You know, not exclusively, but most of them have a pretty, pretty nice-looking technical setup here. And the case for the uranium, for the price of uranium going higher, is a very, very easy case to make. So the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, Yellowcake PLC on the LSE, these are ways you can own, quote unquote, own uranium and just own the commodity. Probably the best risk reward. You're not going to see leverage like you see with miners, by owning the physical. But the downside here, in my personal opinion, is very, very limited for the physical commodity. So it's basically a bet on the commodity going higher. And these equities are extremely volatile. They never go perfectly in the direction you think they will. But over the long term, the trend is intact and will continue to move higher, in my opinion. So I'm excited about speculating at this particular point, looking at the valuations of the miners compared to the metal. We're actually literally back at valuations, you know, at the very, very inception of this bull market, because we've seen such a big reset in valuations, yet the uranium price continues to move in a very clear and obvious bull market fashion.
Well, Justin, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. I intentionally let it run long because it's such a fascinating topic. Before I let you go, I do want to give you a shot to plug the Uranium Insider newsletter that I subscribe to, very much recommend. It's basically your guide from you and your partner, Rick. Maybe you can tell people what's on offer, how much it costs, and what they get.
Sure. Yeah. So we've been operating this newsletter since August of 2019. I'm doing this with my partner, Rick Sachs. He's a retired hedge fund manager with 30 plus years in the precious metals and resources space. He's been a great partner on this venture with me, and we've built up quite the community here. We provide a 30 to 40 page monthly newsletter. We provide members only webinars where we speak with industry professionals in the nuclear industry. And we provide almost daily video updates that I do on an almost daily basis, where I cover news flow that day, a look at market technicals, et cetera. The cost is $5.97 for the year, $1.97 for the quarter. We have a very high renewal rate, which I'm very proud of. It tells me that we're doing something right here. We go deep into the macro. Most importantly, we cover the fuel cycle extensively. It's important to understand all of this in order to have conviction, because the volatility is so high. But you're not going to have outsized gains without outsized volatility. That's as a market rule. So what we try to do is we take as much of the complex information around the nuclear fuel cycle and the uranium industry and distill it down into what that means for investors, so that our members have a clear understanding of this market and a clear understanding of where we expect the market to go. It's been a fantastic experience. It's an all-encompassing venture. Every single day, all day, this is all that we do. And surprisingly, there is always something to read and think about and discuss in the nuclear energy world and in the uranium mining world. And we're excited for the next few years and potentially beyond for this investment.
Well, Justin, I look forward to getting you back for another update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Justin back on the show. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Justin's picture that says Looking for the Downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with EIA inventory.
EIA printed a drawdown of 6 million barrels of crude oil. Now, that's, of course, just about perfectly erasing last week's bounce, which was a build of 5.9 million barrels. And, of course, that came on the heel of 2 weeks ago, we had the biggest drawdown in recorded history. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 837,000 barrels. So, again, we see the same phenomenon there of a big drawdown offsetting the much smaller bounce that we saw of 159,000 barrels last week. Gasoline drawing down 261,000 barrels. Distillates building 296,000 barrels. So, on the finished product side, we're basically balancing each other out, really no change. We don't have the big drawdowns, but we do see them on crude this week. U.S. production ticked up another 100,000 barrels to 12.7 million barrels. So we were struggling, couldn't just get past 12.3. All of a sudden, wham, we got to 12.7. Boy, they must have really, put some more rigs to work. No, I think it's an anomaly in the reporting. One of our listeners who's deeply into the industry has shared with me in email that his data has for months now been suggesting that 12.6, 12.7 is more like the realistic number. And those lower numbers that we were seeing from EIA were probably wrong. Don't know if he was right or not, but certainly the data that we're seeing now seems to confirm that he was. So, Mark, if you're listening, thanks for the tip there. We'll see what happens. I do think it's very important to see whether or not U.S. production can continue to grow, because frankly, there's no other plan for how we're going to get enough oil supply to meet growing demand and get the economy back to pre-pandemic growth trajectory unless we increase production someplace in the world. If not in the U.S., where else is it going to come from? And with all of the ESG policies, there's good reason to wonder if we're going to be able to grow production. So this is definitely a very good sign that we're seeing larger numbers in U.S. production. I hope they continue. Overall, big picture, just as we anticipated last week, we had been through a lot, 6 or 7 weeks in a row of up. We were overdue for at least some kind of pullback. Finally, we're getting it. So far, as I'm speaking, we're looking at just over $79 on WTI. That's down from almost $85 at the peak. I think we're probably headed back down to 77 before this correction is over. That would be the 200-day moving average in the continuation chart. If that holds and we resume the rally from there, and then if we take out $85, that would really be the signal that the upside rally is in place. The question is, how much farther does it have to go? Our friend Anas Al-Haji is reiterating his call that it does not go over 100 this year. I still think there's some more upside to it, but I think probably 2024 is going to be the really big move year for a new uptrend in crude oil prices.
Well, Eric, it has been an epic run. Over the month of July, about 6 weeks altogether, crude oil ripped $17 from trough to peak. And it was inevitable that we were going to have a retracement. This is the very principle of how markets work, like ebb and flow. And a typical pullback could be as much as a 50% retracement. Obviously, a much more shallow one lies right around those moving averages, that $77 level where you had. And the way I look at this is it traditionally would be a buy on dip on any first pullback. So as we get to these levels, the way I look at it is the higher that the short-term bottom comes in, the more bullish it is. And alternatively, the deeper oil corrects, the more likely oil is going to be maybe still stuck in those trade ranges of 2023. Now, my first view here is very similar to your 77 level. I think where all those moving averages lie around the 75 to 77 zone should contain the initial selling. And I'm going to be looking to see whether a buy on dip develops here. Well, the most bullish thing that could happen is that within a week, we see crude oil trading back into the low 80s and just completely reversing all the short-term weakness. And that demonstrates that a new round of accumulation and dip buying is becoming quite evident, and that trend could very easily continue from there. Nonetheless, what's your thinking here on the equity markets?
Well, the market's been selling off for a couple weeks now, and we've taken out the 50 and 55 day moving averages to the downside. So 4306, which is the 61.8 Fib retracement level for the overall bear market, that was my prior top target for the bear market rally. Obviously, I got stopped out of that trade. Maybe that's going to be retested as support soon, and whether or not that holds is going to be critical. So I'm still persuaded by the bear fundamental arguments, but you know what we've seen pretty consistently is those bear fundamental arguments made perfect sense, and the market just kept rallying. It seems like it's finally done and rolling over, but the question is, rolling over how far? Let's wait and find out.
Well, let's get Nick involved in the conversation here. And Nick, what are the technical levels? You're starting to watch now the September OPEX, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Patrick. Yeah, so for the September OPEX, current spot price is 44.05 on SPX. The expected move for that OPEX is plus minus 150 points. So right now, the upper expected move would be 45.55, and the lower expected move would be 42.55. There's currently a call wall above at 4,500 and a put wall just below at 4,400. And we have key resistance above at 4,450 and key support at 4,400, 4,350, and 4,300. I'm inclined to think that over the next month or so after Friday's OPEX, that being August 18th OPEX tomorrow, we're going to see a large move in either direction, either up or down by about 100 points over the next couple of weeks as gamma rolls off. I'm thinking downside perhaps to 4,300 and pretty fast if we do break that 4,400 mark. So for the time being, I'm a bit of risk off right now.
You know, Nick, I agree generally with your levels, but to me, the key level was already broken. Last week, we talked about the idea of how important the 4,500 level was. It was either going to be, in my mind, a very shallow, you know, 5-6-7 day correction that held at 4,500 and would be used like a springboard to launch a retest of the highs and or even punch 4,700 on the upside. But if 4,500 was given out, was what we were talking about, then it opens the window to following a deeper and more prolonged correction, similar to the one we had in February, March, that was that 300 to 400 point variety that takes almost close to a month to play out. And with the break of that 4,500 level the way we did, in my mind, that has now made it clear that this is not one of these short 5 day kind of little quick 100-150 point pullbacks. And so now, if we just use the base case of the analog of how the February March sell off played out, then it comes to that same level you just talked about, which is around that 4,300, give or take. And I think that at this stage, on balance of probabilities, the market is very likely heading there. Now, it's not going to be a straight line. We've had so many of these day after day sell days that typically one little upside rip at some point, a 50 plus point day, just to check the decline and stop out anyone who's got stop losses a little too tight, is a very natural reaction. But right now, this coming down toward 4,300 is what I suspect is the path of least resistance. The other noteworthy thing is that a lot of the previous highs throughout the first and second quarter were all developing around 4,200. The point is, I'm actually not so sure I'm so bearish that I think that we're going to crash here or something. Even if we do drop another 100, 150 points, I think that it will be bought on dip, and probably going into the first weeks of September could send the market easily into a 1-2 week rally, taking another stab at retesting previous levels up above before we see a bigger topping formation develop. And so a little bit more short-term weakness, just in line with what you were thinking. Nonetheless, let's get it to the Qs. What levels are you watching on the NASDAQ?
Spot price right now on the NASDAQ on Qs is 363. Now, the implied move for the September 15th OPEX is plus minus 17 points. Now, the upper expected move there is 380, and the lower expected move is 346. We have a call wall just above at 370, and we have a put wall just above actually where we are right now, which is actually interesting, because if we close below this level, it's possible we shoot down more and test out key support level of 355. Key resistance right now is at 370, then 380, and then obviously at all-time highs just above. But again, as I said in previous weeks, I'm pretty bearish on big tech, as it's had a pretty serious run this year. And I do see it coming down if the market sells off. And I see it actually underperforming the broad market as a whole as well.
You know, the interesting thing is that that June 26th low on the Qs basically still has actually not been violated, but we're at least trading down into it. But when you're looking at the S&P 500, it's actually still well above those that June consolidation low, which just continues to show that the distribution in the NASDAQ is dominant. There is definitely some sort of sector rotation going on. We saw some of the flows going into obviously energy, into healthcare, and certainly out of the big tech. And that's going to be interesting to see whether that trend persists throughout this entire cycle. But what's been most surprising to me, Nick, is that even though we're breaking some key technical levels, and clearly the selling is starting to emerge, I would have already suspected that the volatility index would have traded back into the first quarter of the year levels, which is around the 20 level. And that's not, we're talking about like where the fear index is blowing out 25 and we have everyone grabbing at huge volatility premiums to hedge at any cost or make downside bets at any cost. But to be still at the 16 handle with this prolonged round of selling, I'm asking the question of whether that somehow signals some degree of complacency that not everyone yet thinks that this is anything that's going to be a big deal. It certainly does not give me any short-term signals that suggest that a market low may be imminent any day now. What do you make of this lower VIX level here?
I agree with your assessment that this indicates a lot of complacency. For one, this level of VIX around 16 or so denotes that we should have 1% daily moves on SPX. And what this indicates to me is that we're seeing lack of call buyers, but also lack of put buyers as well, in which case the VIX kind of idles in this range. Again, as the puts have gotten a bit more expensive over the past few weeks, you're seeing complacency in buying insurance, but that may also denote that there's lack of upside bets being made as well. So we're seeing lack of upside bets and downside bets, which leaves us in this narrow range between 15 and 18-ish on the VIX. Again, we probably need some kind of exogenous event to occur that would spur a larger move up on the VIX and a correlating decline in broad markets. So I don't really put much weight overall into the VIX, you know, bouncing around this range. But again, if we see a break above 20, that's when I would probably be more averse to taking long positions, perhaps, and maybe more inclined to sell some premium. And likewise, if we see a decline below 15, I think it's probably going to indicate that we're going to push back up toward that 4,600 recent high mark on SPX. Now, moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here?
Well, the strength we're seeing is definitely impressive, and it's consistent with the Fed minutes echoing what I've said right here on Macro Voices for many weeks now, which is the market has been assuming that a dovish pivot or some end to rate hikes is certain and imminent, when neither of those things is really true. The dollar is telling us that the market has finally woken up and realized that its fantasies of a dovish pivot were unrealistic. But the critical question is whether this strength in the dollar is temporary or if we're headed towards, you know, a new trend to 116 or higher on the Dixie, which was the previous high. For now, I'm still leaning toward the idea that the high is probably already in, but a sustained move over 104 on the Dixie would force me to reevaluate that view. So let's see if we take out 104, which has played a very important role in this market, both as support and resistance in various moves over the last several years.
Eric, it has to be impressive the fact that the US dollar recovered to the degree it did. When that July breakdown occurred and it broke to a fresh new 52-week low, it really looked like a US dollar floodgate could have opened. My thesis all year was that we'd have far more of a trade range bound dollar going into some sort of economic slowdown. And that breakdown really was making some big questions as to whether or not there was still more downside to come. But the fact that we've seen such a strong recovery in the dollar, where wiped out now the entire downside sell-off and put it right back into that trade range. My trade range is in that 101 to 105. I know you're mentioning the 104 level because of the May highs. But to me, the dollar is now back deep into this trade range that we've been in all year. And if we continue to see the pattern that the consolidation stays in this and old dips are being bought, particularly if we see any period where the euro sustains below 109, while we see right now the US dollar yen ripping to a fresh 52-week high, we see the US dollar against the renminbi at a fresh high. This is an environment where the US dollar is actually gaining some short-term traction, and I'll be really curious if that by September it leads to some bullish price action, which I would not yet want to say with confidence is here. It's simply a recovery, but it's certainly a much different dollar chart.
Now, on page 8, we have the gold futures chart. What are your thoughts here, guys?
The spot price of gold traded below $1,900 on Wednesday, although the December delivery contract in the futures market, which is what most of the charting programs quote as the current price, is still up around $1,925, thanks to steep contango in the market. I think we have lower to go before this correction is over, and the reason is exactly what we just covered on the dollar. The Fed is going to continue hiking as long as needed to fight inflation. And when the market convinced itself right after Silicon Valley Bank failed that surely the Fed would never hike rates again, that's what took us up to retest all-time highs. I think what it will take to break through those highs into a new structural bull market is for the end of rate hikes that the market already duped itself into thinking has already happened. That needs to really and truly happen for real, I think, before gold really moves to new all-time highs and we really get a serious bull trend in play. And I think so far it's been false alarms. So let's wait until the Fed actually tells us that they're done and they actually begin a campaign of cutting rather than hiking rates. Until then, I still see plenty of room for still lower numbers before this is over.
Eric, there's no other way to put it, but the price action on gold has just been so incredibly weak. It's been so distributive. The sequence of lower highs and lower lows is so evident. Distribution is still happening. This is an environment where obviously interest rates are rising, and at the same time, the dollar is strengthening. Just everything is signaling the window from which gold traditionally does well. I would imagine that the next major kind of bull sequence in gold will likely line up when we have an easing cycle on the monetary policy side, which at this moment seems a distant part into the future, maybe something that isn't even in 2024 story. Point is, right now, it coming down to that 1900 level on that December contract is really the path of least resistance. And we'll just see where it finally settles in from all of this distribution. Nonetheless, I wanted to just touch on two other quick charts. I wanted to touch on the uranium U308 contract futures. We are 50 cents away from it breaking above that May-June high. And it'll be really interesting to see if it does manage to break that and head over to last year's highs, which are much closer to the $63-$64 level. Uranium has been in a very distinct uptrend, and it's one of the few things that continues to work in a market that is very heavy and distributive. And the last chart I wanted to touch on is that 10-year Treasury note futures. Obviously, most people look at the yield now trading at that, you know, 4.25 or higher level. But we now have obviously the reciprocal where the 10-year yield is trading right back to those October lows. And the bigger question is, who will prevail? There's some very big names that came in there with some very aggressive shorts on these bonds, betting on, 5% yields. When I really kind of step back and look at where we are in terms of the economy, where we are in the monetary cycle, where we are in all of these different elements, I find it a very difficult time on a macro space to be overly bearish bonds. I'm actually suspect as to whether or not this ends up being a bottoming formation that falls off here. Now, we're selling right into it. It's such an early moment to even stick your neck out to make that call. But this is such an important crossroad right here on the 10-year bond futures. And you just have to watch. It's going to be really, really interesting what happens in the week to come.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as Justin's slide deck and the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.